Unscripted.
Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor Dillon here.
And Gabe. Oh, Connor Dillon, that, you've never done that before.
I thought I'd try it.
Do I have to say I'm Gabe Borud?
Well, we talked about names recently. Mm-hmm. I guess it's more about your first name. In any case, we have emails. I think one of them connects to the names. Why don't we go ahead and go there?
Should I do that one?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Hello, Connor and Gabe. Love your show, exclamation point. I'd like to mention that this study doesn't quite make sense to me. And he's talking about the study where your first name will literally shape your face, your physiognomy.
So later in life, if somebody looks at a picture of you and has four names they can choose from,
yeah,
they'll probably choose the right one.
Their guess will be better than random chance,
yes,
which means
that's it.
There's something to it. I've never felt connected to my name and look forward to changing it when it's convenient. I'm sure there are others like me for various reasons, whether it's their name not fitting them, childhood bullying, or in the case of trans people, experimenting with names until they find one that reflects their true self, or all of the above. Based on this study, do people who feel unconnected to their names have blander faces? Or perhaps faces that remain unchanged and similar to their childhood appearance, just older?
That one.
What about twins?
Yeah, but, so, okay, two different questions there, but that, it would be the latter and not the former. So if, I guess, if that suggestion is true, if I'm not connected to my name in any way, it's just like this word that happens to be attached to me, and hence I'm not shaped by it or by the social expectations of that name throughout my life, then it's not that I have a blander face, it's the same face, but it would look...
I'm not going to comb my hair like a Gabriel would comb.
Oh, his, yeah.
Or
there is a way for Gabriels.
Hair.
Yeah, every Gabriel has one hairstyle.
Well, I mean, that would be the idea that somehow society means that you do something to your face or your face does something to itself that makes it a Gabriel.
Right. Very good question. Speaking of
from
names.
From Everett, by the way. That was from Everett.
From Everett. Thank you, Everett. Speaking of names that do have an association, an email from Jude.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Jude.
I know. And I'm sorry for that. That probably has followed you your whole life. Lots of people... thinking that or making that immediate association.
It's a great song.
Jude writes, I feel like I'm taking a chance sending this email. I used to correspond with DW decades ago using an old address that got hacked. Long story short, for years I would get spam I knew was from DW because it was in German. Well, sorry, Jude, that happened. It's not going to happen with this email. It's a long email that goes on to say it's about conspiracy theories. Last episode, we talked about... a new bot. That research, by the way, I don't think we emphasized that enough, had just come out. That bot was new, or they'd used the research on the bot was new.
While we were speaking about it, there was still an embargo on publishing anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So right when we went live with it, that was when people could start talking about that study online and elsewhere.
And just a refresher, that is an online tool, debunkbot.com. Where you can go and basically feed it any conspiracy theory that you maybe even believe in yourself, mm-hmm. and get very calm, dry answers, factual answers about why that's probably not the case. Very interesting tool. We also talked about the birth of a new conspiracy on that show, a very ugly one, implying that a certain group of immigrants in the United States were potentially eating pets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of you understand that reference without us saying anything more about it. The assertion in this email from Jude is basically like, look, don't give these people airtime. Don't let this nonsense propagate by even talking about it on this show on Science Unscripted.
There was one line in there in particular. Can I see that email for a second?
Yeah.
Where Jude writes, let's not give them what they want. Because if we do, it will only encourage them even more. They're just selfish jerks.
Yeah, interesting use of language there. There's a lot in that email about how what needs to happen is we need to shame the people responsible for this, that shame is an important social tool. Jude, to respond directly to your question, I think it's a very good one. It's one that we asked ourselves before, during, and after that segment of the show. Are you making the problem worse by repeating the false allegations, even though you've said a million times they're false? I don't believe so. I think if you package it well enough, and in that case, attach it to a tool that can debunk this kind of stuff in the future in a way that most of you can use, I think that's constructive. And I'm just going to follow up on a YouGov study, and it took a look at how, in this case, Americans reacted to the information that was presented throughout the debates and whether or not they believed it. And 9% said that was definitely true, that that's happening. 17% said it's probably true that that's happening. And then another 20% were not sure. If you add those numbers together, you come up with 46% of a gigantic population not really sure whether or not something is true. And I think it's fair to address that on a show like this one and to say conclusively that it isn't. I think that probably does more good than harm. That's my take on it.
Yeah. Let's jump into some science, huh?
Yeah.
We're going to start with a dark topic that I think is important. This is a study out of Colorado. They looked at the relationship between sleep and suicide in a very specific part of the United States, young kids. So kids between the age of 9 and 10, they had a survey done. This was between 2016 and 2021.
We're talking about 9 to 10-year-olds?
9 to 10-year-olds. The first part of the survey was longitudinal, so they first wanted to know how these kids were sleeping. And we're talking about a set of 8,800 kids. So they asked them how they're sleeping, determined their sleep quality. And then 2 years later, did another survey where they wanted to screen for suicidal behavior.
So now they're 12 or 13.
They're 11 or 12.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Yeah, they started out at 9 or 10, and now they're 11 or 12 years old.
Right, for the kids who weren't sleeping well at baseline. And it's important to note that at baseline, those with suicidal ideation, because there was screening for that in the first survey as well, they were taken out because they wanted to see the development over time of suicidal ideation. For the kids who weren't sleeping well at the age of 9 and 10... At the age of 12, it was 2.7 times more likely that they would have suicidal ideation, that's either passive or active thoughts of killing themselves, 2 years later.
2.7 times more likely?
2.7 times more likely. And if they had nightmares, even occasional nightmares, it led to a 74% increase in this suicidal ideation. And if they had nightmares every night, five times more likely that you would have thoughts of suicide than if you didn't have nightmares.
So a correlation here. It sounds like causation, but still a correlation. It's a chicken or the egg problem. Are they sleeping poorly, hence they have these dark thoughts?
Yeah.
Do they have the dark thoughts, and hence they are, as a result of that, are they sleeping poorly? But it doesn't really matter because the two are connected.
Suicide is way too complicated. There are so many factors that go into it, but this is one visible factor. Now we know that if a 10-year-old is not sleeping well, or someone between 10 and 12 years old, it's one way to check out. Are you doing all right?
So real quick,
it's one thing to talk about with a specialist.
Yeah,
because this now exists. This research did not exist before. Now it does.
So real quick here, I didn't know the details of the study prior to just hearing them. But one thing I did know, or I'd heard you say, is that there's been a jump in the last couple of decades in young people.
Over the last 20 years, so since, now a little bit less than 20 years, since 2008, the suicide rate in the United States for kids has doubled. And it's a constant increase. So every year, there's been an 8% increase every year annually since 2008. 2009, it goes up another 8%, goes up another 8%. It's constantly going up. And we're not, that's successful suicide, or suicide where the person dies. For every successful suicide, there are 20 attempts. The behavior is increasing. And the ideation is clearly increasing. And there is a clear relationship, whether it's causal or not, or whether it's just associative, between poor sleep, nightmares, and suicidal ideation.
Something for parents to watch out for. And again, just
and
a reminder.
And coaches and teachers and anyone who knows a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
If that kid complains about not sleeping well, that is to be taken seriously.
Just a reminder, if anyone out there has thoughts like that themselves, or you're aware of somebody who does, hotline. Call a hotline immediately. Gabriel and I cannot sit here and give you any meaningful advice other than that. There are professionals out there who can. And we will leave that there. But important information.
Mm-hmm.
Watching out for that clue. I'll go into something a bit more positive, if I may.
I was hoping.
That one scares
yeah,
me.
I was hoping.
Yeah, that one scares me. This one is connected somewhat thematically because it touches on feelings of depression, anxiety, and stress. And as you were saying before, these are how many factors go into those feelings? Hmm. Thousands. It's impossible to isolate any one or to say, change this one thing about your lifestyle. Yeah. But there's an interesting attempt to look at one way to improve it. And this is from the British University in Egypt. A researcher, her name is Amani Safwat El-Barazi, got 100 college students from the university, presumably. And the only caveats here are that they're kind of young, obviously, and that they were, I think, for every one guy involved in this study, there were two women. So it's slightly skewed in that direction.
Okay.
In any case, she took the 100 people, college kids, split them into two groups. 50 are the control group, so we can forget about them for now. 50 are in the experimental group. And they filled out three surveys. Two of them were actually important. One was, to what extent are you feeling? It was the DASS-21 survey. To what extent are you feeling depression, anxiety, stress in your daily life on mm-hmm. a scale?
Generally, not in this moment right now, just...
Generally speaking, yeah. There are a lot of questions in there. I can't say I went through every single question on the test, but it gives you a snapshot today of where people are at.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other survey was kind of the second factor in the whole experiment. How assertive are you in your life? How assertive?
Mm.
And that made me stop because then I was trying to define for myself, what is assertiveness exactly? So it can be used positively. It can be used negatively. People can be too assertive. And so let me just kind of remind myself and everyone, it's saying what you need and not being afraid to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Or feeling ashamed of saying it. It's the idea that you can communicate to someone, look, I need 30 minutes. It's not you. I need 30 minutes of silence right now because I just need to de-stress. And that's just that it's respectful, has nothing to do with you, Gabe.
Yeah.
I just need quiet time for Connor.
What if I came in the office in the morning and said, Connor, I need a good podcast from you today?
You would be making demands of me, and that would be a sort of in a
so
negative
what
way.
What I need.
It's mostly about what you need. You are being respectful while you communicate it.
Okay.
Aware of the fact that not everyone can always respect exactly what you need.
That's an important part.
This can be for work, talking to your boss. Look, I'm at my limit. I'm at my threshold of what I can possibly do. And I just need to let you know that mm-hmm. because otherwise I'm going to burn out and burn up.
Okay.
It can be in your private life with your kids. Hey, enough. I need. Anyway.
Back to Egypt. So we've got a survey on how assertive are you? How anxious or how depressed people are and how assertive these people are.
So let's go back to the experimental group. They broke them into three subgroups, 15 people in one, 15 in the other, 20 in the other. I don't know why they did that. It bothers me. I like when every group is the same size, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
They then had 10 weeks of assertiveness training based on a manual that's kind of a standard in the field of behavioral therapy.
Good.
Assertiveness training. They were in groups doing this, 10 weeks long, and I'll pull up the numbers here in my mixture of papers, and it seems pretty clear, again, on a relatively small sample size, young people, that, for example, if you were in the control group, your stress at the beginning was a 12.7, and at the end it was a 12.4. That's enough to say it didn't really change. If you're in the control group, meaning you had none of these interventionist trainings, your anxiety was 8.9, and at the end it was 8.7. So it basically didn't move.
Pretty much the same.
If you got the assertiveness training, your stress at the beginning was almost a 12. At the end of it, it was a 9.6.
Oh.
Your anxiety dropped from a 9 to an 8. Your depression from a 13 to a 12, and your assertiveness, because they also had to measure, did this actually do anything? Are they more assertive? Went up from a 65 to a 71, whereas the control group, who didn't have any of this training, they stayed flat.
Wow.
So what can be said here is that over the course of 10 weeks, if you have somebody helping you to be assertive every single week, that this can improve things because... possibly, I'm speculating here, but one aspect of these feelings of stress, anxiety, and depression would be connected to the fact that I'm just not as good as I wish I was at communicating what I need, and now I have someone training me to do that, and that this relieves some of those feelings.
Yeah, we can't give our listeners right now a 10-week course in assertiveness, but is there one thing that they could work on right now? One way to become more assertive? Say something to the mirror in the morning, or what?
Yeah, I think the one, because I looked at how many different web pages and how many different specialists, therapists, doing it in different ways. Boundaries, it's like almost at the top of the list everywhere, meaning if you're feeling exhausted, overwhelmed because life is so fast, what are your boundaries? And how much on a day-to-day basis, what am I, if you're going into work or if you're going into a stressful situation, what do I want? Identify that in advance. What do I want out of that situation in a way that's fair? And more importantly, how do I communicate that need?
To other people.
In a respectful way. Hey, this is just how I operate. This is, if I'm going to do this project, I need an email with these bullet points in advance. I'm happy to do the project. It's just how I operate. You know what I mean?
So first think about what your boundaries are. Think about that on your own, figure it out for yourself, and then communicate it somehow.
With the subjective I that was listed on a lot of different places. This is not how everyone operates. It's how I do. Huh. And I'm weird in my own ways.
All right.
And that'll help people kind of to identify with the way you operate. Yeah.
All right, Connor. Well, what do you guys have to say about anything we talked about today?
Especially if you have other tips on being assertive. I admire people who can communicate that better than I can.
What does being assertive mean to you? Tell us at su@dw.com. Was that being assertive?
A lot of our listeners out there are very aware of the fact, possibly because of this show, that alcohol, one of the world's favorite beverages, is pretty bad for your body. But it's odd to think about how that act could damage the health or the mental health of a person sitting next to me that I love or who loves me. Hmm. That's a different way of looking at alcohol consumption.
There has been work done on what alcohol does to relationships among older people or people who are already married. There is no work done on what it does to young relationships or people between the ages of, let's say, 18 to 25. That's what the topic we're going to be talking about today. And we wanted to go out to the streets of Bonn to see if we could speak to young people about that. Everyone we spoke to, we must have spoken with 50 college kids here.
Yeah.
Asking them, do you think your partner drinks too much? They said no.
Yeah, I don't know if there is data to suggest that Gen Z, younger generations, are drinking less alcohol than the generations before them. This would be great news. I've seen Gen Z themselves, or people claiming to be them, responding online that, yeah, we do other things. We vape e-cigarettes like crazy. We have other addictions like our phones, et cetera, et cetera. So it may not be, you know, any better than before, but alcohol seems to be dropping. We talked, all of them, no. No, I've never...
Sounds like an interesting topic, but no, I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Yeah.
The only person we found was a woman who said that she almost got involved in a relationship with someone who had an alcohol problem.
But I think that was a factor that made me not want to even think about him romantically.
Why not?
Because that's a lot of baggage that I wouldn't want to have to deal with. I think that precedes a degree that I'm not willing to take on. Yeah.
So that was, I don't know what her real name was. She didn't want to give her real name. She called herself Lily.
Lily.
Yeah. Okay. Making a choice she later said was the right choice because now she's happily in a relationship with someone else and isn't having to deal with the alcohol issue. But yeah, apparently not a huge issue for the students at the university or close to the University of Bonn here in Germany. But in Texas, specifically at Texas Tech,
Texas Tech.
A big thing.
Yeah, a study has been done there on what your perceptions of how much alcohol your partner drinks and whether it's problematic, what that does to your own well-being and to the well-being of the relationship.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, my name is Katie Himes. I am a PhD candidate at Texas Tech University, and we conducted a study on perceived partner drinking and its impacts and correlates with individual and romantic relationship well-being.
In a sentence, Katie, what was the takeaway from your study on drinking and your partners?
Sure. So I think the big takeaway for us is that perceptions of your partner's drinking matter, and they can impact your well-being, your individual well-being, and your relational well-being.
And we're talking now about what I think my partner drinks, or that my partner drinks too much. It's not their perceptions of my drinking, just so that we're clear here.
Yes. So when we're talking about perceptions, that's two different indices of drinking. So one is how much you think your partner drinks, and the other is drinking problems. So do you perceive your partner's drinking to interfere with your relationship with them?
So it doesn't really matter if my partner is drinking under the limit of alcoholism. They might be having a glass of wine every evening. If I think that's problematic, that's the issue, right?
Absolutely.
And when that happens, when I think that my partner, the person I'm in a relationship and with, has a drinking problem, what does that do to me?
What we found is that it really matters how much you drink as well. So typically, if you are drinking at similar levels as your partner, you might not be as distressed. However, in our study, we did find that men who are drinking similar amounts as their partner do experience increases in anxiety symptoms when they're in this partnership characterized by mutual heavy drinking.
Why would it happen that direction? I would have expected the opposite, if I'm totally honest. I would have expected that women might be concerned that a guy like me, if I'm drinking high levels, I don't know, there are all these old cliches, I might get violent, I might get aggressive, I might get ornery, I don't know. And yet it's the other direction. If my, in this case, female partner is drinking more than I want her to be, I think it's kind of problematic, my anxiety rises. Why?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different pieces of nuance here. So one is that the drinking partnership is characterized by heavy drinking by both partners. So it's not that there's discordant drinking where the female partner is drinking more. We just didn't find that kind of partnership in our data. Another is that, well, I don't want to speak beyond our data. So we didn't assess things like intimate partner violence or something like that. But there are a couple of different reasons that we think this might be occurring. One is that women tend to have higher symptoms of anxiety than men anyway, so they might be less impacted by their male partner's drinking. Another is that in general, men tend to drink more than women, although rates are converging over time. So alcohol acts as a short-term anxiolytic, which means that it reduces anxiety in the short term, but it's a long-term anxiogenic, meaning that it increases anxiety over the long term. So it's possible that for men who are drinking more, they're experiencing this biological increase in anxiety. It's also possible that they're relying on their female partners for more practical support. We know that men tend to rely on their female romantic partners as their primary source of social support, so they might feel disruptions there that could lead to increases in anxiety. And the other kind of hypothesis that we're floating around with is that anxiety itself might change how you're perceiving your partner's drinking. So if you are already more anxious, you might respond worse to your partner's drinking, although it could be either direction.
If I wanted to know if my partner had a drinking problem, are there any... What are the telltale signs, or the red flags, or the warning signals that there's problematic drinking happening?
Are we speaking about broadly or within the context of a romantic relationship?
Within the context of a romantic relationship, what do I have to look out for?
Sure. So if you feel like your intimacy with your partner, physical, emotional, is disrupted because of your partner's drinking, if you feel like your partner is maybe not showing up for you as much as you would like them to, they're neglecting household tasks, they're neglecting, you know, date night with you, emotional intimacy, if it feels like their priority is on the use of a substance, that might be a sign that there's a drinking problem interfering with your relationship.
You looked at 18 to 25-year-olds, if I'm not mistaken, and Gabe and I went out here in the city of Bonn in Germany and talked to a bunch of them to see if we could not replicate your study, obviously we can't, but to see if we could gain some insight based on how they responded, how they've experienced this themselves. Almost no one had anything to say on it. They haven't had a part. I guess my real question for you is, how did you find so many 18 to 25-year-olds who already had partners with problematic levels of drinking?
Yeah, great question. So in order to be included in my study, all that had to happen was at least one partner had to endorse lifetime drinking. So we weren't just recording or recruiting people who were reporting drinking problems. Importantly, though, we did want to focus on this younger sample in dating relationships, not in married relationships, because the existing literature really focuses on older adults who are in these married relationships, rather than looking at younger adults in dating relationships. And we know that these relationships can still be profoundly impactful. And at least on an American college campus, we see really high rates of drinking in this sample. So it was really important for us to capture how this drinking might be impacting social relationships and vice versa.
One of the women that we spoke to out in Bonn, she hadn't herself been in a relationship, but she knew someone who had a drinking problem and he was open about it. And because of that drinking problem, she did not enter a romantic relationship with the guy. I'm wondering, for the people who are involved in a romantic relationship with someone with a drinking problem, how do you address it? What are the tips for people out there to even bring it up?
Yeah, this is a great question. So I will say my answer is contingent on someone being in a safe relationship physically and emotionally. But if someone is in a safe relationship, the best thing to do is start a conversation about it. Talk about how it's impacting you, maybe what your concerns are. Allow there to be a dialogue, ask questions, get curious. If you're feeling like you need support because of your partner's drinking, it's really disruptive for you. It can be really hard to convince someone else to get help, although we can voice our concerns and encourage that. But if we're experiencing subjective distress in regards to our partner's drinking, that might be a sign that we might be able to go and seek help and get support if that's something we need, whether from a peer or from a mental health professional.
Maybe also a reminder for people out there who are enjoying the glass of wine or beer or whatever it is in the evenings to check in with their partner and be like, hey, I tend to do this. Are you okay with that? Do you feel as okay with this as I am?
Absolutely. I think the best thing to do is have conversations early and often and keep them ongoing. Always have it be an open discussion. Things might change if someone is trying to, you know, get into a career rather than stay in school. We might have a different threshold of tolerance for what we're comfortable with our partner doing.
Why did you get into this topic, Katie?
That's such a good question. So I'm really interested in social relationships in general, and there's not a lot of work, actually, contrary to what we might think, on the intersection of substance use and romantic relationships, especially, like I said, in this younger population. And so I'm really interested in looking at that in terms of alcohol. I'm looking at cannabis now. So really across substances, how is this interacting with our relational environments and how is that impacting ourselves?
And that was Katie Himes speaking to us from Lubbock, Texas, Texas Tech University.
As we said at the beginning, or before the interview with Katie, we failed spectacularly in trying to meet real people who've experienced this problem in the way it was described in the study. Mm-hmm. And hence the open question for real to all of you out there listening to this right now. Have you ever been in a relationship, or have you seen a relationship where this happened, where one of the parties was having a tough time because of the alcohol consumption of their partner? That's I would be very, very interested in hearing those stories.
Yeah, this one, I can't help thinking about my own wife. What does your drinking do to your partner as well? And you mentioned it in one of your questions. Every time you have a drink, do you ever think about your partner when you consume alcohol? Almost never.
Not really.
That kind of opens that idea up to me.
Sometimes you kind of think like, now I'm in a more cheerful mood. Well, I'm going to be more effervescent in loquacious.
The reason why I'm drinking so I don't have to think about my partner.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on what is a really interesting way to think about alcohol? SU@DW.com. Please email them to us. Thank you.
DW, made for minds.